Welcome back to the Health Longevity Secrets Show, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin. How can blood biomarkers inform our quest for health and longevity? Is there a better way to systematically apply artificial intelligence and other tools to use this critical information? Today, we speak with Gil Blander, PhD, who is the founder and chief scientific officer of Inside Tracker, and host of the Longevity by Design podcast. An expert in nutrition, biomarker analytics, athletic performance, biochemistry, and aging research, he holds numerous patents and has published peer-reviewed articles in these areas. He received his PhD in biology from the Weizmann Institute of Science and did postgraduate research on aging at MIT in the famed Lenny Guaranty Lab, which has spawned such longevity leaders as David Sinclair, David Kennedy, and Matt Kaeberlein. Before we start the episode, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the work we do, as well as joining us on your personal health longevity journey. You can do both by becoming a member of our community. The benefits include a private messaging area, live QA sessions, weekly premiere videos, product discounts, free giveaways, and much more. You can join for as little as $1 per month, and the first month is free. See the link in the show notes for more information. And now, please enjoy this interview with Dr. Gil Blander. Hi, Gil. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Robert. I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's so great. We're going to have so much fun today. I can't wait to talk about all these exciting things. But maybe before we do, let's just take a moment, if you don't mind, and perhaps tell us how you came to be so interested in these fascinating areas.
Yeah, so I'm you can hear from my accent that I'm not a Native American. I was born and raised in Israel. And from a very young age, I was fascinated by the aging process, and I wanted to stop the clock. I wanted to live forever. I want to understand why we have aging-related diseases. So that's why I decided to study biology, and to cut a long story short, I done my PhD at the Weizmann Institute of Science, and I started to study longevity or aging there. And then in 2002, I moved to Boston, to MIT, and spent 5 years at the lab of Lenny Guaranty, that might be considered one of the leaders, or maybe the leader of aging research. So that's a background about my fascination and why am I so excited about the longevity field.
Yeah, what a great pedigree in that space. And also, to be involved in that lab, in Lenny's lab at that particular time, which has spawned so many thought leaders in longevity, in addition to yourself, but you know, David Sinclair, David Kennedy, Matt Kaeberlein, among others. I wonder, what was it about? What was it about that lab? Was it nature or nurture, or was it seed or soil, or was it just the lab or the combination of people? What was it about that so many great ideas and great people came out of there?
Yeah, I think that it's a mix of both. I think that Lenny is a super smart person. And also, I think that a lot of professors in the academia, after a while, they are doing more politics than being a real researcher and reading a paper and trying to understand what is going on. And Lenny really liked it. So you can rarely come to his office and don't see him reading a paper, which is a unique phenomena. So I think that Lenny, because of his fascination of aging and fascination of understanding what is going on, came with a lot of ideas. But on top of that, because he is so good, he recruited a very good student and a postdoc to join his lab. So I think that the mix of that made the lab so exciting.
Yeah, and you've continued on in, obviously, in the longevity space since you were there. I wonder what were the What were the most significant changes in longevity since you were at MIT, since you were there? In other words, maybe what were the disappointments, the things you thought were going to be ground changing and weren't? And what were the surprises, the stuff you didn't see coming at all that shapes longevity in today?
Yeah, I think that there are a few differences from, let's say, 20 years ago to today. First, we have now a few very interesting, potential drugs that we haven't had before. In the pre-recording, we discussed rapamycin, which is one of them. But we also have metformin, which it's a very interesting currently drug, actually, that might be repositioning to a drug that can allow you to live longer. You have all the NAD derivative that came from Lenil's lab, and there might be an interesting drug in the future. So that's one way to look at that. Another way to look at that is that now we understand better and better that it's not only drug, it's also lifestyle. And we started to quantify it and to see that a lot of the things that we can do today with our lifestyle can significantly increase our lifespan. I can give you an example of a paper that was published, I think, a couple of weeks ago that actually show and start to quantify that if you eat red meat and you are 60, you have on average a chance to live 2 years less than someone that doesn't eat red meat. Okay, or if you are consuming beans every day and you are 40, you have a better chance to live 5 years longer to someone that doesn't eat beans. So we are starting also to see like a dose effect of specific intervention. And as I mentioned to you 2 minutes ago, it's all about nutrition, red meat and beans. And what is the effect on the population on longevity? Thing that we haven't had before. So I think that it's the drugs, but also a lot about our lifestyle and how important is our lifestyle for our longevity.
Yeah, it's been amazing the factors about lifestyle. I mean, doctors always tell their patients, well, you need to eat better and exercise more. But I guess the message is confusing. There's not consensus about what eating better means and even exactly what exercising means. But for me, it was just eye-opening in the last decade or two about the significance of lifestyle changes, how they can treat and prevent all these chronic diseases and ultimately longevity and everything with that. It's really, really remarkable, even more than the drugs to some extent. We're all trained to look for drugs and look for silver bullets, but so many of the drugs that we've developed don't even treat the underlying cause, and the underlying cause needs a lifestyle change really to take care of it, whether it's type 2 diabetes or coronary artery disease or Alzheimer's disease. It appears, yeah, there's not necessarily a drug for that. So how are you working with that now? Or I guess before we leave that, about your podcast in the longevity space, what have you learned from that and your guests? I know it's fairly new, but Longevity by Design has had some great speakers on it. And, What have you learned from that so far?
Yeah, first I learned a lot because as we discussed before, I need to get ready for each interview. And you learn so much about research and what your guests are doing. So I think that I learned a lot. But high level, I learned that there is a lot of lifestyle effect. There is a lot of progress in the longevity field. There are some genes that I used to work at MIT. When I used to work at MIT, used to be something that we said, oh, it's an interesting. For example, if you look at what Lenny worked on, which is the SIR family of deacetylase, they have seven member in human, SIRT1 to SIRT7. And the majority of us focus on SIRT1. And what is now looks like that 36 is really the star. And there is a data that showed that it's extend lifespan. There is data that show that it's actually a tumor suppressor, basically a gene or a protein that prevent cancer. There is data that show that without it, you cannot survive. There is data that show that it's very important for glucose maintenance and metabolism. So something that at the time that I spent at Lenny's lab, we ignored it. In the last 20 years, there is a lot of data that show that CLT6 is a very important gene. So that's very interesting. Another interesting thing that I learned for a scientist called Vera Gordonova is that there are a lot of new model organisms. So we always look at least in the aging field, at yeast, worms, flies, and mice. Okay, that's sometimes the monkeys. But she's looking at a different, completely different kind of model organism, like a naked mole rat, or she's looking at whales, and a lot of other different kind of model organism that might be a better model organism than looking at yeast and worms and so on. Another fascinating discovery, or not discovery, information that I learned from Matt Keberlein is that he's doing a very interesting study on dogs and aging of dogs. And those are domestic dogs, that basically dogs that live with us. And the rationale for that is what he's saying, and it makes a lot of sense. The dogs live with us. They feel the same environment that we feel. They almost eat the same food that we eat. So basically, if you see something on dogs, most likely we'll see it also on human. It's much more closer to us than to look at the mice in the lab. So I think that there are a lot of improvement in the, let's say, the vehicle or the subject that we are looking at right now in order to build a better model for us to see whether a specific drug or specific intervention can allow us to live longer, better life.
How do you conceptualize longevity and aging? What's your personal model of it after being in this space for so long?
Yeah, you can look at it at two different ways. I think that's a very important question. One is how long you live from the day that you have been born to the day that you will die. That's basically longevity or lifespan. And then you have what we call health span. So it's not the lifetime that you live from birth to death, but actually the time that you live and you are, let's say, disease-free. How long do you live that you are disease-free? And I think that health span is much more important than lifespan because nobody wants to lie on the bed and connected to a lot of tube for the last 20 years. It's not fun. All of us want to live until the moment that we die in a way that we can climb a mountain or view a nice movie in LA or go to the beach in Santa Monica and have fun. So I think that it's very important to understand that, at least for me, health span is much more important than lifespan. And I think that also the scientific community in the longevity or the aging research are trying to focus more and more on the health span than only on lifespan.
Yeah. So what then, what is the secret to increasing the health span, or what is your model for the problems with longevity and chronic disease? How do you conceptualize it?
Yeah, so I think that, again, before recording, we discussed about looking at the amount of calcium that you have in your arteries and all of that. We need to understand that the aging-related diseases are not starting when you are 40 or 50 or 60 or 70. They are starting very early. And it's all about prevention. So you need all of us, we need to think about it from very early, very similar to the retirement account of 401k. You need to think about it as you are saving for your retirement. And you need to eating well, you need to sleep well, you need to be sure that you are exercising, you need to be sure that you are in the right environment. All of that will influence your health span and also your lifespan. And you need to start working on it as early as you can. And it's not something that you can say, oh, okay, when I will be 65, I'll take care of it. Maybe it will be too late for you. So that's what I'm suggesting for your audience.
Yeah, that's been a revelation to me too, as a physician in this field, that exactly what you're saying, diseases like Alzheimer's disease, by the time you have the diagnostic criteria of cognitive impairment or, you know, memory problems, it's now understood that the Alzheimer's disease has been happening for 1 to 2 decades. The same thing with diabetes, that by the time your glucose rises above the criteria to be diagnosed as diabetes, you've been insulin resistant for at least a decade. And, you know, by testing things like fasting insulin or C-peptides, you can get a handle on that as well. But it's amazing that these chronic diseases, if we wait until we show up in the doctor's office, it's not too late, but it's much harder to treat after these advanced symptoms have occurred. And it's basically changing the way our healthcare system and the way we look at health. And before we get into that and some of the ways I know you're working on and doing that, I want to just sort of circle back to sirtuins one more time. And I mean, that's amazing me about this, the sirtuins, the AMP kinase, the mTORs are all interlinked, and many are nutrient sensing. So when we're going to talk about lifestyle, and we'll see how that's important, but it appears like that all of these things are driving through our nutrition, through our lifestyle, are driving things that create chronic disease, whether it's insulin resistance, inflammation, coagulopathy for heart disease and all. And it seems like they're all related there. So the challenge is sorting through the complexity of these network effects and getting to the bottom of it. And the company that you founded, Inside Tracker, maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that came to be, because this fits right into sort of what we're talking about and can potentially address some of these questions for us.
Yeah, definitely I can. So when I arrived to MIT, I started to be exposed to an area that's called Kendall Square. It's basically the area around MIT. Which have maybe thousands of companies in the biotech, high-tech, pharmaceutical, and so on that are flourishing there. And again, it's the MIT effect, because MIT is so good. There are so many companies that are spun out from MIT. For example, Moderna, the company that made the treatment for it's actually originated from Kendall Square, and it's still the headquarters is there. Like the vaccine that saved us from, hopefully saved us, we'll see later, from COVID, is actually part of it is originated in Kendall Square. So I started to be exposed to this environment, and I realized that maybe I can contribute more to humanity for start a company than being a professor in the academia. So after 5 years at Lenny's lab, which it was amazing and fantastic, I decided to move to the industry. And I joined a company that done a system biology, computational biology, looking at a lot of data and try to make sense from that. And then when I joined them, I said, okay, I'm still really fascinated about aging and longevity. Let's build the model for caloric restriction, which is one of the natural intervention, and maybe we'll discuss it later, that have been shown to extend lifespan in every model organism that have been tested. So I said, let's take all the data that's available, run it via this computational biology tool, and see what's happening under the hood. What are the processes that caloric restriction is modulating, like you mentioned, insulin and the AMP kinase and the serotonin pathway and all of that. So I built a model, and I've seen that there are around 18 different processes that are modulated by caloric restriction. But when I looked at resveratrol, which is one of the compounds that David Sinclair found that is an activator of SIRT1, and I tried to see what resveratrol controlling, it was only 2 out of those 18. So it still done something, but it was very small. So that drive me to the understanding that even the best compound at that time that can modulate longevity only cover a small amount of a portion of what caloric restriction is doing. So then I said, together with other scientists, we might need 20, maybe 50 different small molecules in order to cover all the effect of caloric restriction. And then we said, if you look at what we have today on our food, or if you look at the data of the USDA, you can find that there are around 8,000 different food that are available for us today. And when we look at it even deeper, we realize that the average American in an average week consume only 20 food items. And if you look, if we try to compare yourself, Robert, to myself, I would say that most likely we cover the same amount of 20. So those 20 are really the same. And we have like a universe of maybe 8,000, but we are using only 20 of them. So we said, why don't we use the food as a drug of choice? Let's try to find what are the issues of each person, because each of us is unique. Each of us have a specific issue today. And let's understand what's happening inside our body, find the issues, and then try to solve them using food instead of drugs or supplements. So we, to cut a long story short, we decided to look at the blood biomarkers because they are validated and calibrated everything. They are something that a physician like yourself are using for more than a century. So there is a lot of peer-reviewed scientific data about them. And also, most of them you can modulate using some natural interventions such as food, but also maybe supplement, exercise, and lifestyle. So we researched the database of companies like Quest Diagnostic, which is the biggest lab in the US. And we found that there are around 4,000 different blood biomarkers. So we realized you cannot test all of them because first, you won't have enough blood in your vein. And second, it might be very expensive to do all of that. So we came with some criteria to select the most important blood biomarkers, and we came with around 45 of those. And those are the blood biomarkers that we are using today. And then when we are looking at the blood biomarkers, we are giving you an optimal zone, not only normal zone. So, for example, if you look at glucose today, everyone should have glucose between 65 to 99, a fasting glucose. Doesn't matter if you are male or female, athletic, active, or a couch potato, a monk, or someone that drink a lot of alcohol. All of us have the same level of glucose, should have the same level of glucose. So we said that that's wrong, and let's give an optimal range to each person based on his age and gender and ethnicity and athletic activity and so on. So we develop an optimal zone for each person. And then if you are out of the optimal zone, we can give you some recommendation of what food you should eat more or less, what kind of exercise you should do more or less, what kind of supplement you should take, or what kind of lifestyle changes you should do in order to optimize this those blood biomarkers. Later on, we decided that blood is not enough, so let's also understand what is your what are the chances or what are the issues that you have based on your genetics. So we had a genetic testing. And very recently, we also had the physiological marker based on a fitness tracker, so we can know what is your REM sleep, and we're working on VO2, adding VO2 max and other. So all of that allowing us to see a high definition picture of your body. And based on that, we can assign to you the best intervention for you to optimize your biomarkers, and hopefully because of that, to live a longer, better life.
Wow, that's so exciting. I want to get into that and come back to glucose a little bit. But before we do, I just want to circle back on caloric restriction that you mentioned. It's one of the earliest time-tested, proven strategies for increasing longevity across species and all. I wondered, how do you view time-restricted feeding versus caloric restriction? What are the differences? What are the similarities? And can you accomplish the same thing with one and the other?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I can tell you that if you look at mice in the lab, I remember when I've done those experiments, so it's much easier for a researcher to do a time restriction feeding than a caloric restriction. And the reason for that is caloric restriction, you need to cut the amount of calories by 30 to 50%. So it's very hard for you to host more than one mice in each cage. And when you pay for the for the cages, you pay per cages, not per mice. So the experiment become much more expensive. Also, you need to go and measure the amount of food. And it's a very hard work for the researcher. Well, when you do time restriction feeding, you pour the food on the in the cage, and then the mice eat it in 20 minutes because they're so hungry, and then you feed them again maybe a day after. So in the lab, it's much easier to do the time restrictive than the real caloric restriction. And a lot of data from the lab show that actually the effect is very similar. Okay, for human, it's much harder also for us to keep in a caloric restriction. There are some societies of some people that are doing it, but it's very, very hard for them to do it because you literally need to be on starvation all the time. And it's very hard for us to maintain it as a human being. So what happened is that some of us decide, okay, let's learn from what happened in model organism and do and imply to ourselves. And instead of feeding ourselves a very little amount of calories, let's just restrict the amount of time that we are feeding ourselves. So there is a method that called a 16-8. Basically, you feed yourself for 8 hours and you fast for 16 hours. And there are a lot of different ways. There are some that doing a 4-1. Basically, you eat normally for 4 days and 1 day you completely fast. So there are a lot of different ways to do it. What the data from the literature show that those methods have been shown to have some positive effect. Again, not on longevity because it's very hard to know. Because we live for 80 years in average, so it's very hard to follow us for so long. But an effect of marker that related to longevity, so the LDL going down, the resting heart rate is going down, the glucose is going down, the blood pressure is going down. So there are a lot of your weight or BMI is going down. So a lot of markers that are related to longevity are becoming better. And because of that, it's a very popular, and also it's much, much easier to do it. For example, I'm following this regime because it's easy for me. I just need to know I'm stop eating at this time and I'm start eating at that time, and that's it. And it's not too much planning. So it's much easier to stick to this method. And what is interesting that it's working for some people and it's not working for other people. So it's most likely some effect of the genetics. So some of us have a better chance to enjoy the effect of caloric restriction. Some other are not. And at InstaTracker, and I'm sure at other places, we are looking into that and trying to find how can we know if you are a good fit for caloric restriction based on your genetics, instead of asking you to go via it and just find it by yourself. So I think that that's a, I know, hopefully it was a clear summary of how I see caloric restriction.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area. And the intermittent feeding is interesting the way you say it affects those things. For example, a person who eats 3 meals a day or 6 meals a day spread out over the day, and then versus a person who eats the same amount of calories only in 1 meal a day over, let's say, 2 hours or something, it'd be the same amount of calories because neither one necessarily is gaining or losing weight. It's their steady state. What is it about restricting the eating window that affects things? Do you have any insight into the mechanisms for that? Why eating 2 hours a day is healthier than eating 6 hours a day for some people, or, you know, 12 hours a day or 24 hours a day?
Yeah. So first, I wouldn't recommend you to eat only 2 hours a day. I would say that it's much safer to have two meals instead of three meals and add the feeding time for 8 hours. So there are a few theories about that. One, if you ask, let's say, David Sinclair will say that it's a activation of the CR2 family. That's what is doing it. I assume that there is some backup for that. But also there are some other effects that are good for us. If you think about, and if you're taking us in the evolution and going back, 1,000 years back or 5,000 years back, we haven't been evolutionary-wise, been designed to be live next to a refrigerator and can eat whenever we want. Our evolution taught us that we need to eat whenever we can. We need to eat, then we eat as much as we can. We fill our tummy as much as we can. And then we might not eat for a few days until we'll find another antelope that running around and will eat it. So I think that it's more fit for our evolution than what's happening today, that we have the refrigerator and I can go and eat whenever I want. So I think that evolution-wise, it makes sense. It also makes sense for your body, your gut, and also your heart and the other organ to relax a bit and not work so hard, because when you digest the food, all the process is working harder. I think that also, I'm not sure that is the cause or effect, but if you look at our population or the BMI of the population right now, where it's going higher and higher. So it might be that the effect is just that we are getting to the right amount of calories. So it's not like we are living longer because we are caloric restriction ourselves, but basically we are getting into our set point. Our set point should be there, but we are way above the set point. So I think that there could be a lot of different explanation for that. And unfortunately, I don't know what is the right explanation.
You know, one thing we've been hearing about, many researchers are looking at, is the sort of flipping the metabolic switch from glucose metabolism to ketones, so beta hydroxybutyrate and acetone and everything. And that happens, of course, you know, about 12 hours after we stop eating and we burn up all our glycogen and everything, all our glucose stores. Then we switch to run on ketones, which are actually fairly efficient, even more efficient than glucose. And that's arguably the normal pattern when people are between meals or not starving, but going for days without food on the plane, hunting for their next game or whatever. And some people are advocating the value of ketosis per se by its effect on flipping that metabolic switch, or it's a result of the metabolic switch being flipped. Ketosis, it's basically the same thing, but the switch goes, it turns mTOR down, turns AMP kinase up and sirtuins up. Do you guys look at markers for ketosis in your fasting people, or is that something you look at as well? Not your fasting people, but your intermittent feeding with your dietary recommendations?
Yeah, not directly, but we have observed that people that on a keto diet, they tend to have a much higher level of lipids, especially LDL and other. I'm not convinced that a keto diet is the right diet. Again, it might be right for a specific subpopulation, but to come and say keto diet is the best diet since the sliced bread, I think that it's wrong to say. The same with any other diet, high carb diet, low carb diet, high protein. I think that it's wrong, and if you think about what Insta Tracker was built on, let's take science, let's understand what are the issues that you have, and based on that, we'll build you a specific diet that is personalized for you. Some people are trying to do is to make it very simple and say, oh, keto diet is amazing. It might be good for a specific subpopulation, maybe people that have a better way to metabolize lipids. Maybe it's better for them, but I'm not sure that it's a good diet for someone that have a very high level of lipids. So that's my opinion. But
Well, jumping back to glucose, then interesting at tracking that and all, and sort of understanding glucose has been a revelation to me too in the last years, even though I went to medical school and practiced medicine for a long time. But the fact that we all know that low glucose is harmful, but the fact that high glucose is very harmful too, and it's a very narrow range that the glucose is beneficial to the body. And at high glucose, we get, you know, glycation, advanced glycation end products and binding to proteins and all sorts of effects. And of course, the result, we see this in diabetics and all from their persistent high glucose. What range do you like to see for your glucose? And you mentioned it in your patients or in the clients in Inside Tracker. Have you found any useful benchmarks for that? You mentioned it varies obviously within different groups of people, but are there any hard and fast rules you could recommend?
Yeah, I think that the rule of thumb is the lowest that you can have a glucose that it's, let's say, above 70 or something like that. It's better. I'm talking about fasting blood glucose. Mm-hmm. But there is a data that we have that it's also part of, it's not a new data. In the Framingham Heart study, they looked at a population of Framingham is a town next to Boston, and basically they followed the population there for, I think, from almost birth to death, and basically looked at a lot of variables, including glucose. And what the data showed very nicely that for a specific person at specific age and specific gender, there is a level of glucose that is the Goldilocks zone, that it's the best for him or her. So basically, based on that, you can come and say that if you are 40 and you have this level of glucose, whether it's too high or not too high. So again, it's very hard for me to come and say you should have this level, because it's all in the formulas and the algorithm that we have at InsideTracker. But we can definitely show you for glucose or any other blood biomarker what is the optimal range for you.
Yeah, yeah. There's only so much you can do with fasting glucose and all. You mentioned several exciting new metrics that you're beginning to adopt with fitness trackers and other devices to get more information, just to going beyond blood markers. Are continuous glucose monitors on the roadmap for you all, or are you doing that now?
Yeah, patients? No, definitely. We are not doing it officially yet, but we are started to research it and started to see how to integrate it. And today there are a lot of buzz about it. And there are, I'm sure that you heard from your patient and your audience heard about a lot of cool and shiny companies that are using it. And I think that the issue that I have with, first, I think that's great. People should try it, and I like new gadget, and it's good for them to do it. But the problem is that there is not enough data to know what does it mean for healthy person that is not diabetic to have a peak that is above the peak or a trough that is below the trough, okay? And I think that we need to understand it better, to crisscross it with blood biomarker data, and to do some research to understand it. And I would be a bit careful to come and give a healthy person a recommendation today about from a CGM or continuous glucose monitoring about you should eat this food or that food, because I think that we need to understand it better. So that's what we are doing right now. We are starting to research it. We're starting to do some experiment. And I'm anticipating that we'll head the CGM to our portfolio pretty soon, but maybe at the beginning it will be more like a research tool that I won't come and tell you, hey, you should have eat more or less of this food because it's better for your peaks, because I want to really understand and be sure that what I'm telling you is there is a real scientific evidence for that. And I'm not sure that the companies that are doing it today for non-diabetic have enough data to do that.
Yeah, you have so many interesting projects at Inside Tracker. One that I love is the InnerAge 2.0. Can you talk about that a little bit, about what it is and maybe how it compares to DNA methylation clocks or glycation clocks or other types of biological clocks?
Yeah, definitely. So just as a background, as we discussed before, I'm really intrigued by the aging and longevity. And a few years after founding the company, I spoke with Lenny Guerrante and David Sinclair, and we said, let's develop something like that. So we spent a couple of years together with David and Lenny, and we came with what we call the InnerEdge 1.0 that was mainly based on a peer-reviewed scientific publication, including the study that I discussed before from Framingham Heart study. And then a couple of years ago, we got to a point that we had a lot of data from our users. So we could actually develop an InnerEdge based on the database that we have. So what we are doing, we are looking at a regression line. For example, it's well known that glucose is going up with age, or LDL is going up with age, inflammation is going up with age. So trying to plot you based on your gender and the age on this graph and see whether you are above the line, if it's going up or below the line. If you are above the line, that means that you are aging faster if the marker is going up. If you are below the line, you are aging slower. And then we combine all of those markers together and come with a one metric that's called InnerEdge 2.0. What is nice about it, then I can come and tell you, your InnerEdge is high because you have high glucose and high LDL and high inflammation. And then I can come and tell you, okay, you want to improve that, so you need to eat this food and you need to do this exercise and you need to do these lifestyle changes. So basically in InnerEdge 2.0, you get the number, one number that compares your chronological age to your InnerEdge. You also get information about which marker making you older and which marker make you younger, and also what intervention you should do in order to optimize it. Okay, so that's InnerEdge 2.0. If we are comparing it, let's say, to the epigenetic clock, or the way that you call it is methylation age, I think that the methylation age is very accurate. I would say that it's much more accurate than the InnerEdge 2.0. But in the flip side, you don't know why you are older. So you don't have the information, oh, it's because of your LDL and HDL. We don't understand why. We just know that it's happening. And also, we cannot come and tell you what intervention you should do in order to optimize it, because the clocks that develop so far are not lifestyle responsive. So I cannot come and tell you, I don't know if you will eat Mediterranean diet, it will make you younger or older. I don't know if you will start running a marathon, it will make you younger and older. There is not enough data about that. So part of the thing that we are doing right now, we are designing an experiment to try to find what are the markers that are all the methylation site that are also responsive to specific lifestyles. So for example, if you are losing weight, which methylation site is changing? Or if you are exercising more. And based on that, we are trying to build a, I call it lifestyle responsive epigenetic clock, okay? And then when we'll have that, that will be amazing. But we are not there yet.
Well, as an expert in longevity and lifestyle and biomarkers, what are the most powerful lifestyle changes you've seen work with your clients, and also which of those do you use for yourself?
Yeah, so definitely exercise have been shown, especially to people that are not exercised, is a very strong, let's say, variable or intervention that you can do if you are not exercising.
Any particular type of exercise, like high intensity or aerobic,
So high intensity interval training have been shown in the literature to show a lot of value. But right now we are writing a paper about running. Okay, a very simple intervention, and what is nice, we have tens of thousands of runners in our database, so we can look at them from a couch potato to a professional that someone that is in the Olympic. And then you can look at this prism and see what is the effect of exercise, also if there is a dose effect, and also come and say, hey, actually, if you will exercise 1 hour, if you run 1 hour a week, you will get 70% of the value of running. So you don't need to run 10 hours a week. It's enough 1 hour per week. I'm not saying that you don't. I'm just giving an example. So you can get also the dose effect. And what we are seeing from analyzing this data is that actually running have a very good effect on almost all the metabolic related markers, in a very profound effect. Also on BMI, a very strong effect on BMI. So people that are running on average, they are much leaner than people that are not running. Again, it's not a rocket science, but it's nice to to see that. So that's one intervention that is I see in our population that is very strong. But there are a lot of other, and for example, taking vitamin D 3 when you have a low vitamin D. Again, it's not a rocket science, but we see that it's working. But we can also tell you, based on your starting point, how much should you take? Because when I started Insulin Tracker 12 years ago, I looked at the recommendation for physician, and it was 400 IU. And I can tell you that I tried 400 IU for a long time and didn't move the needle. Not for me, and I see it also not for our population. So I see that if you really want to move the needle, it should go much higher, maybe 2,000 IU per day. You start to see the effect. But what is nice about Insulin Tracker, it can tell you exactly what you should take based on people like you, and also how long you should take it. So it's starting from, let's say, silver bullet as a vitamin D, and go to as a complex, or not complex, but hardest intervention such as running. And you see all in the between. There are a lot of different foods that we have seen that having a very good effect. Oatmeal is a good example that we see that people that consume oatmeal improving significantly the metabolic related markers, namely the lipids and the glucose. So there are a lot of different interventions. As I said before, we have thousands of different interventions that we can fit for the right person.
Oh, that's great. And how about you? Any particular food choices or lifestyle choices in your life, knowing what you know about your needs and your metabolic health?
Yeah, so I'm doing a time restricted feeding. So I'm trying to do it every day. I'm trying to exercise every day. And I'm trying to do one day aerobic and one day strength. And the day of strength, I'm also doing yoga. I feel like, at least for me, I see that yoga makes me much more calm. So I'm trying to do it as much as I can. I'm also trying to do massage as much as I can because I'm exercising. Again, not a lot, but for someone in my age, and I'm exercising like an hour a day. So I'm trying to do massage and make my muscle feel better. And the yoga also helping. Nutrition-wise, I'm trying to at least 1 or 2 days a week to try to not eat meat. So being a flexitarian. And if you look at the literature, being a veggie person is one of the best intervention to improve your metabolic level, but also increase maybe longevity. It's not easy to do, but I'm trying at least, I don't know, 2 or 3 days a week not to eat meat. And my goal is trying to do it 7 days a week, but it's not easy. I'm trying to eat more fruits that are high with antioxidant and high with fiber, like berries and other. So I'm doing a lot of a modification that helped me to optimize myself. I'm also trying, in Insulin Tracker database, we have almost 100 different supplements that have been shown, medically shown, to improve specific biomarkers. So I'm trying to play with them every time and try to see which supplement is working better for me. So I'm doing a lot of experiment in parallel.
And then circling back to the beginning of our conversation about supplements or drugs for those longevity genes, the sirtuins, AMP kinase, or mTOR, are you taking metformin, rapamycin, resveratrol, NAD supplements, any of those?
So for me personally, I'm not taking them. And the reason for that is I'm trying to be a bit conservative with something that is not natural. So I'm not taking them. I'm not saying that nobody should take them. And if someone believes and it's supplement, it's approved to take them. But for me specifically, I decided not to take them yet.
Yeah, and certainly we really don't really fully understand those things. And there are a lot of unknown questions. And two of those drugs are by prescription only, the metformin and the rapamycin. It's definitely a lot of questions that hopefully we'll understand better in the next few years. I thank you. We're going to be able to offer a discount for people who want to try out Insight Tracker. And we'll leave that in the show notes and have that information. And Gil, how can people get in touch with you? We're going to list all your connections and everything down in the show notes. But for anyone who's listening to the podcast, maybe you could just tell them how they can follow you on social media or the website.
Yeah, so the website is insighttracker.com, and you can visit there. And there is a page about us that you can find, and there is a link to my LinkedIn. So you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter, or you can find me on Instagram. I'm actually very excited to talk with our customers or users. So I'm trying to at least interview one of them a month or something like that, just to, it's like a physician. You need to practice medicine in order to call yourself physician. So I'm thinking that as a founder, I need to interact with our users in order to say that I'm still understanding what our audience would like to have. So I'm trying to talk with them, and I'm trying to interact with them. And actually, we have a team that right now interview customers, so, and they're recording it. So I'm viewing that. Try to understand really what is the need from the market. I think that's very important for me to know it. So I would love to communicate with your audience if they are having any question.
Great, great. And will those interviews will any of them be on Longevity by Design?
No, it's basically internal interview of customers.
Internal use only. I see that. Well, this is such an exciting time in this space, and I want to thank you for taking an hour to spend time with our audience and with me. And I want to thank you for the great work you've done over the years and the great work you're doing with Insight Tracker as well. So thanks so much, Gil, for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Robert. It was my pleasure.
This is for general information and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to constitute or substitute for medical advice or counseling. The practice of medicine or the provision of healthcare, diagnosis, or treatment, or the creation of a physician-patient or clinical relationship. The use of this information is at their own user's risk. If you find this to be on the value, please hit that like button to subscribe to support the work that we do on this channel. And we take your suggestions and advice very seriously, so please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we hope to see you next time.